Powers by David D. Levine. At 9:35 a.m. on Monday, May 2, 1960, an unexpected knock sounded on the door of Franciszek Majewski's office. Frank's desk was closest to the door. He stubbed out his cigarette and prepared to answer it.
"Just a moment," he said.
Most of Frank's documents were already properly stowed in color-coded folders, according to their classification, all tidily aligned with the desk's edges. He put his current working set away in its folder, then glanced at his two office mates to make sure they had done the same. Although it was early on a spring day, the windowless office was already stuffy with Washington heat. Harsh fluorescent lights hummed over battered war surplus file cabinets, scarred green and white linoleum, battleship gray desks edged with decades of cigarette burns. The four heavy safes along the back wall were properly flagged with green open cards, their doors shut but unlocked during the working day. Frank was preparing an intelligence estimate of Soviet bomber production capacity. His folders contained documents in Russian, German, Polish, and English. News articles, intercepted telegrams, reports from field officers summarizing the findings of their agents. The latter, although the freshest and most exciting, were also the most suspect. Even if the facts presented weren't deliberate misinformation, they could be mistaken, misinterpreted, or completely fabricated by agents desperate for money or thrills. Nothing was certain in this business. That was why they were called estimates. But through careful correlation of the available information, a sharp analyst could come up with a highly probable guess at the truth. The man at the door was Robert Amory, Jr., tall and lean, and, unlike Frank, still in possession of all his hair.
"What a pleasant surprise," Frank said as he shook his hand.
Robert, the man who had recruited Frank to the CIA, had been his immediate superior before being promoted to Deputy Director of Intelligence. He held a folder in one hand, a red one with a top-secret label.
"I need to speak with you, Frank," he said. "Alone. Come with me."
Frank swallowed hard. He took off his wire-framed glasses and polished them with his handkerchief to hide his discomfiture. As they walked down the corridor, footsteps echoing on the travertine, Frank felt sweat trickling down his sides, even more than the already muggy day warranted. Any disturbance of routine was worrisome, and having the attention of his superiors focused on him was more worrisome still. Would this be the day he'd been dreading for so many years? Robert led Frank to a vault he'd never even walked past before, closing and locking the heavy, soundproof door behind them. As the two of them sat at the small table that filled most of the vault's antechamber, Robert offered a cigarette. He smoked Marlboros, which Frank found too harsh, but he gladly took one to calm his nerves. Robert tapped his cigarette into a heavy glass ashtray with the CIA seal, then extracted a sheet from the folder. "Sign this."
"Ooh. What is it?"
Frank's pulse throbbed behind his collar button. "I need to read you into a new compartment." Reading in was the process of authorizing an officer to access a certain compartment of classified information. The sheet contained a brief description of the compartment. It was a photo reconnaissance project involving high-altitude overflights of the Soviet Union, and the usual statement that Frank understood that unauthorized disclosure of any information from the compartment would subject him to penalties up to and including life in prison. Robert had already filled in Frank's name, date of birth, and social security number at the bottom, and Frank signed it with a sense of relief. Frank didn't yet know why his security clearance was being raised, but whatever the reason, it implied that his secret was still safe. After Robert countersigned and filed the form, he pulled another folder from one of the vault's drawers. "Welcome to Aquatone." Each compartment was identified by a cryptonym, or code name, beginning with a two-character prefix called a digraph, that designated its geographical or functional area. Aquatone's AQ prefix indicated it was a type of technical asset. Robert slipped an 8x10 glossy from the folder and slid it across the little table.
"This information doesn't leave this room under any circumstances. Aquatone is one of the blackest projects we have."
Stamped "Top Secret Aquatone," the photo showed an airplane. An extremely unusual airplane. The wings were freakishly long and thin, the fuselage slim as a cigar. It might have been a glider, except for the jet exhaust at the rear. It was painted entirely black,
completely lacking in markings or insignia.
"This is the Lockheed U-2, Robert said. "It has a ceiling of 70,000 feet, top speed of 510 knots, and can remain aloft for up to 8 hours without refueling. We've been flying this plane over Russia for almost 5 years."
Frank realized the ash was about to fall from his cigarette and flicked it in the ashtray.
"What kind of photos can you get from that altitude?"
70,000 feet was practically outer space. Robert gave a grim little smile.
"Very good ones, and the Soviets don't have anything that can stop it." He looked Frank in the eye. "At least, we didn't think they did. But on Sunday, one of our U-2s didn't come home."
He handed the folder to Frank. Frank set down his cigarette and read the papers inside, all stamped top secret aquatone. The plane had taken off from Peshawar, Pakistan, and was supposed to overfly Stalingrad, Archangel, and Murmansk, looking for evidence of ICBM launch facility construction and maintaining absolute radio silence. But it was now well over 24 hours late for its landing in Bodø, Norway, and it had to be considered lost.
"What happened?"
"We don't know. It's a very temperamental airplane. Could be equipment failure or pilot error."
The last sheet in the folder was another photograph. A cocky-looking fellow in a flight suit with laces like an old-fashioned corset.
"That's a pilot, Francis Gary Powers. He's one of ours. All the pilots and support staff are agency personnel."
The pilot had a hard jaw and dark eyes. He looked to be a little older than Frank's son, maybe 30.
"We know that plane went down somewhere in the Soviet Union. I want you to find out what the Soviets know. Did they shoot it down? Did they even know it went down? Have they found the wreckage, and if so, what have they learned from it? The plane is equipped with a destructor unit, of course, but it might have failed."
"And the pilot?"
A hard, level stare. "Equipped with a curare needle." He puffed reflectively, blue smoke from his nose. "But to make the plane fly that high, that far, it's basically made of toilet paper, Frank. If it goes down, the odds of survival are 1 in 1,000,000. Frank picked his cigarette from the ashtray. Ignored, it had burned almost all the way to the filter. He took one last bitter drag and stubbed it out.
"Why me?"
Although Frank's heart had slowed as he realized his personal secrets were not the reason for this visit, he still didn't relish the attention the assignment would focus on him.
"I know you, Frank. You're a native Russian speaker. You've got a good eye, and I trust your judgment. And if you do well on this, it could be a big boost to your career."
He gave Frank a conspiratorial wink.
"Thanks."
He tried to smile. Frank arrived home at 11:10 p.m. that evening. He slipped his key into the lock and opened the door as quietly as he could. But his wife was awake, in robe and slippers, gnawing her nails as she stared out the living room window. She turned to him as he entered, her round babushka face illuminated by relief that shaded immediately to anger.
"Where were you?"
she said, her voice strained.
"I'm sorry I'm so late, Kohanya," he said, and bent to kiss her cheek. "I got a new assignment today. I was so tied up in it that I forgot to call."
In fact, he had spent most of the day in the aquatone vault, where no phone line penetrated. She hugged him tightly.
"I was so worried about you, Serduska,"
she whispered into his shoulder.
"I was afraid that scare had found you."
"Not today, Kohanya."
He stroked her hair.
"Not today. Our secret is safe, for now."
Frank remembered every detail of the day that secret had manifested itself. It had been a fine spring day in 1952. Frank was crossing C Street, obeying the walk signal, when he glanced to his left and saw a green 1950 Packard bearing down on him. Frank was seconds away from becoming a bloody pancake on the street. Suddenly there was a rushing sound in his head, and the car seemed to slow to a crawl. Frank had pushed himself backwards, feeling as though he were wading through glue, unable to breathe. A moment later, the car sped past. Frank stood shuddering in the street, wondering what had just happened, and ran a hand over his sweating head. It came back with hair stuck to it. He'd always known that he'd go bald, like his father, but hadn't expected it to come on so quickly. Another such incident had occurred a few months later, when his wife's favorite vase fell off a table, and another month after that, when one of his nieces was threatened by a vicious dog. Frank hadn't become a successful analyst by ignoring data. However unexpected or counterintuitive, and he soon became convinced that his experiences were not just subjective. He had developed an extraordinary ability, an ace. But tail gunner Joe McCarthy had just begun his hearings, claiming increasing numbers of secret aces infested the government and negative feelings were beginning to build. Part of Frank's job was to understand and predict political trends in other countries, and he could tell that the life of an ace in the government would shortly become extremely unpleasant. And though he'd been only 8 years old when the Bolsheviks had taken over Russia, forcing his wealthy Polish-born parents to flee to the United States, he knew that being different from the mob in a difficult time could be fatal. At first he hadn't even told his wife of his abilities, but she was smart and observant, and after she noticed how, in moments of stress, he sometimes appeared to flicker, he'd been forced to confess his secret to her. Ironically, she still didn't know he worked for the CIA. McCarthy's hearings were over now, but fear and distrust of aces remained. Anyone who discovered they had unusual powers was required by law to report to SCARE, which would assign them to jobs in which their powers could be used for the good of the nation. But SCARE had only ever acknowledged two instances of this: Lawrence Haig, the telepathic stockbroker, and David Harstein, known as the Envoy. Neither of them had ever been seen in public again. Sophia sniffed and wiped her eyes on the sleeve of her robe.
"I'm sorry I snapped at you," she said. "Every time you're late, I worry that you've gone to, you know, Nevada."
One of the more outrageous theories as to what happened to aces who vanished into SCARE was that they were transported to a top-secret facility in the Nevada desert, a place which they were never allowed to leave except when required for the performance of their duties.
"You know that's just a rumor," he said.
But he knew the Russians' forced labor camps were real, even though the Soviet government tried to keep them secret from its own people. The United States would never do such a thing, would they? Another car drove past. Its headlights through the Venetian blinds, sweeping an arc of striped light across the bedroom ceiling, and Frank sighed and sat up. Despite his exhaustion and the lateness of the hour, sleep eluded him. While Sophia snored gently in the other bed, Frank slipped on his robe and slippers and shuffled to the den. This room, with its warm wood paneling, had been his children's bedroom, and the shade of the lamp he now switched on was still painted with cartoon airplanes. But Jenna, the youngest, had married and moved away 3 years ago. He seated himself at the chessboard and opened Botvinnik's 100 selected games to the bookmark. Game number 89, Felush versus Botvinnik, 1945. He set up the board with quick efficiency, then proceeded to play out the game from the book, pausing at White's 10th move to consider the alternatives Botvinnik discussed. He tried just reading, playing out the games in his mind, but actually handling and moving the pieces made the player's strategies and attacks much more comprehensible to him. Chess made sense. Even though the player's strategies and plans were hidden, the rules were known to everyone. The moves were made in plain sight, and even check had to be declared. But real life was full of hidden dangers. If SCARE were watching Frank, he might never know it until the hammer came down. After he'd played the game out, Frank yawned, replaced the pieces in their case and the book on the shelf, and headed for the bedroom. As he passed the hall mirror, the headlights of another passing car briefly illuminated his scrawny limbs and growing paunch, and he paused. There had been a time, not long after his power had manifested, when he'd considered turning himself in to SCARE. He'd entertained juvenile fantasies of a life as a daring ace secret agent, with exciting adventures and a code name. But even then he'd been too old and settled for adventure, and now the man in the mirror was 51 years old and looked 60. Frank shook his head at the image as he closed the bedroom door behind himself. Frank shaved with a straight razor, using a cake of shaving soap and a mug and a badger hair brush, just as his father had. Even Frank's barber used a Gillette razor and shaving cream in a spray can. He said it was easier, neater, and safer. But Frank liked the close shave and the sense of control he got with a straight razor. The old ways were best, and certainly cheaper. But at 8:15 a.m. on Thursday, May 5th, Frank regretted that habit when the voice of Nikita Khrushchev burst from his bathroom radio, saying something about a bandit flight being shot down. The premier's voice was immediately overlaid with a translation into English, but Frank had heard enough. Too much, in fact. Dabbing at the cut on his neck with a styptic pencil, Frank cursed under his breath in Russian, Polish, and English. He had worked over 14 hours on Wednesday, but not a single thing he'd seen in all the sources he'd studied had led him to conclude that the Soviets were even aware of the downed U-2's existence, and he had turned in a report to that effect before leaving the office at 9 o'clock the previous night. He'd failed. Frank's brain swirled with second guesses and recriminations as he tightened his tie over a neck still unshaven and damp with soap suds. What had he missed? There had been that one ambiguous data point, something about an increase in security forces in the city of Vladimir. But, though it had nagged at him, he'd been unable to correlate it with anything else, so he had omitted it from the report. Maybe he should have investigated further. On the radio, Khrushchev continued to berate the Americans for their aggressive invasion, accusing them of playing with fire and seeking to torpedo the upcoming Paris summit meeting. Frank twisted the knob to another station. It was that troglodyte Elvis Presley threatening to squeeze you tighter than a grizzly bear. Frank wasn't sure whether Presley or Khrushchev was the bigger threat to America. Disgusted, he switched the radio off. Before Frank could even hang up his hat, his office mate Galen informed him that Robert Amory wanted to see him as soon as he got in. Robert's secretary directed him to a crowded conference room. The air in the room was blue with smoke, and Frank didn't know half of the men in it. One he couldn't fail to recognize was Alan W. Dulles, Director of Central Intelligence. With his white hair and mustache, rimless glasses, and old-fashioned collar, he looked more like a banker than a spy. At the moment, his expression was grim, jaw clamped tight on the stem of his pipe. "I'm glad you're here, Frank," Robert said after he'd made introductions. "We're briefing the President in..." He shot his cuff, glanced at his watch. 25 minutes, and I'd like you to attend." Frank's mouth went dry.
"I'm sorry, I didn't..."
Robert cut him off with a wave of his hand. "We'll talk about what went wrong later. Right now, we need to get our feet under us." The West Wing conference room used for the briefing, with its colonial print wallpaper and oil portraits of Revolutionary War generals, reminded Frank of nothing so much as a dentist's waiting room. But when President Eisenhower entered, Frank felt an electric jolt. This was real. This was history. Frank had never before been in the same room as a president. The familiar face beneath Eisenhower's bald dome looked tired, and he walked with a slight limp, but the eyes behind the glasses, with their thick, transparent plastic frames, seemed searching and intelligent.
"Well, gentlemen," he said to the room at large, "we seem to have a bit of a situation here."
The question on the table was whether to fess up, as the president put it, to admit that the lost plane had been on an espionage mission, or to stick with the prepared cover story, which was that the U-2 was a NASA research plane that had accidentally strayed into Russian airspace. The CIA men present all argued strenuously for the cover story. As Dulles said, "Although all nations spy, no one admits it." But Thomas Gates, the Secretary of Defense, worried that if Khrushchev had physical evidence of espionage, the United States could be caught in a lie.
"We don't want to go to Paris with egg on our faces," he said.
But the president didn't really seem to be listening.
"What I want to know is, what about the pilot? Could he possibly have survived?"
Frank was amazed to hear so much concern about one man from a general who had commanded tens of thousands. Kelly Johnson from Lockheed, a pale man with a florid complexion, spoke up.
"Well, sir,"
the engineer said, dabbing at his brow with a handkerchief,
"the aircraft is equipped with an ejection seat and a survival kit, but frankly, sir, those are provided mostly to reassure the pilot."
Eisenhower's face sagged at that revelation.
"For security reasons, the operating protocols call for the aircraft to spend all its time over Russia at or near its ceiling, which, as you know, is 70,000 feet, and no one has ever bailed out at anything like that altitude and lived."
The president's eyes pressed closed, and he bowed his head for a moment. When he raised his head, he looked 10 years older.
"Very well," he said, his eyes flicking back and forth to take in everyone in the room. "That being the case, we'll stick with the cover story. Thank you for your time, gentlemen."
As everyone in the room rose, chairs scraping across the linoleum, Eisenhower shook his head and muttered,
"May God have mercy on us all."
If Frank had been 5 feet farther away, he wouldn't have heard it, and he was touched by the man's humanity. By Friday, Frank's superior seemed to have forgiven him for his failure, though he hadn't forgiven himself, and he worked all day on the question of what the Soviets knew about the U-2. Photos of wreckage had been published in Pravda, and Grichka, the Russians' first deputy minister of defense, had given a speech at the Supreme Soviet claiming that the American air pirate had been shot down. But there was no indication the Russians knew of the U-2's mission or capabilities. But there was one nagging piece of information, or rather lack of information, that worried him. There was a rising KGB officer, an ambitious man designated Icicle, who seemed to have dropped off the earth on May 1st, the same day the U-2 had gone missing. At this point, though, Frank had nothing to connect the man with the U-2 but a vague intuition. As he locked his papers in the safe for the weekend, he resolved to dig deeper on Monday. On Saturday, May 7th, Frank was washing his lovingly maintained 56 Rambler in the alley behind the apartment building when Sophia opened the bedroom window and called out,
"Frank, it's someone named Robert. He says he needs to speak with you right away."
Frank dropped the sponge in the bucket and ran up the steps two at a time. Puffing, hands still dripping with soapy water, he took the call in the den.
"You need to come to the office now, Frank."
Robert didn't sound pleased.
"Yes, sir."
There was no point in asking for more details on a non-secure line. When Frank arrived at Robert's office, without a word, the deputy director handed him a sheaf of flimsy yellow telefax pages. It was a transcript of a speech Khrushchev had given to the Supreme Soviet a few hours earlier.
"Comrades," the premier had begun, "I must let you in on a secret. When I made my report, I deliberately refrained from mentioning that the pilot was alive and healthy, and that we had the remnants of the plane."
Frank looked up, aghast.
"Keep reading," Robert said.
"We did this deliberately," Khrushchev's words continued, "because had we given out the whole story, the Americans would have thought up another version. The pilot is safe and sound. He is now in Moscow. His name is Francis G. Powers. According to his testimony, he is a first lieutenant of the U.S. Air Force, in which he served up to 1956, when he joined the Central Intelligence Agency."
There was more, much more. Names, dates, flight plans, all accurate. Photos from the plane's cameras, which Khrushchev described as not bad. Even the curare-tipped needle with which Powers was supposed to kill himself. The cover story of a weather research plane that had gone off course by accident was completely exploded. Powers would be tried as a spy. If found guilty, and the Soviet courts were not known for their leniency, he would face a firing squad. Frank dropped the speech on the desk in front of him and massaged his temples. He desperately needed a cigarette, but in his haste had failed to bring any from home. At that moment, the door slammed open, and Alan Dulles strode into the room, pipe clamped between his teeth. He seemed about to speak to Robert, but then he noticed Frank.
"What is he doing here?"
Frank sat paralyzed, held in check by the director's gaze.
"Frank is one of our finest Soviet analysts,"
Robert protested. Dulles cut him off, pulling the pipe from his mouth and pointing at Frank with its stem.
"He completely failed to spot the fact that Khrushchev had the U-2. Never mind Powers. I want him off this assignment. Give me someone who can tell me what's really going on over there."
With one last withering glance at Frank, he turned and stalked out. After a moment of stunned silence, Robert slumped in his chair.
"I've never seen him that angry before," he said. "Ever."
Frank gripped the edge of the desk.
"I did the best I could with the available intelligence, sir,"
he said, amazed that his voice didn't tremble. Robert pulled a pack of Marlboros from his desk drawer. Gratefully, Frank accepted one as well.
"It's not just you, Frank," Robert puffed as he lit up. "There's something else going on here, and whatever it is, it's something I'm not privy to."
He blew out a plume of smoke.
"I'm sorry, Frank. You really did do your best. You just happened to be in Alan's line of sight at the wrong moment."
Frank took a deep drag, but it didn't help much. Although his heart was slowing, he knew that he had just severely damaged his career, and maybe Robert's as well.
"I'm sorry, too."
At least, he told himself,
he would no longer be in the spotlight. Over the next few days, the crisis deepened. The White House released a statement blaming the Russians' excessive secrecy for making the U-2 flights necessary and berating them for attacking an unarmed civilian airplane. Khrushchev shot back that Eisenhower was a stooge of the Pentagon militarists and their monopoly associates who really ran the country. Meanwhile, in Washington, the Democrats took the opportunity to harass a weakened Republican president, saying that it was almost incredibly stupid to send a spy plane over the Soviet Union immediately before the Paris summit. One senator even accused Powers of being a double agent, which prompted an immediate personal denial from Eisenhower. All during this time, the State Department negotiated with the Soviets to try to free Powers, but it was clear the Soviets knew they controlled the center of the board. They refused to negotiate and proceeded rapidly with plans for Powers' espionage trial. Soviet Defense Minister Malinovsky threatened that air bases provided by United States accomplices for U-2 overflights could easily be wiped out. Secretary of Defense Gates, in a carefully worded statement, emphasized that the United States would defend its allies in the event of an attack. Finally, blinking in the harsh light of newsreel and television cameras, Eisenhower made a statement. "With a heavy heart," he said, "I must announce that the United States is withdrawing from the planned four powers talks in Paris. Under the current circumstances, the prospects for peace seem remote." As he spoke, the Strategic Air Command quietly raised its readiness level to DEFCON 3. Tuesday night, May 10th, or maybe early Wednesday morning, Frank stared at his chessboard, smoke curling from the cigarette between his fingers, as he contemplated the endgame of Botvinnik's game number 90, Romanovsky versus Botvinnik, 1945. Frank sympathized with Romanovsky, who'd made a straightforward mistake in move 10, but then compounded it, becoming flustered by surprise after surprise from the Grandmaster Botvinnik. If he'd only been able to keep his wits about him, but he hadn't. Romanovsky had lost his concentration and the game, and Botvinnik had gone on to become Soviet champion, then world champion 3 years later. The creak of the den's door startled Frank from his reverie. It was Sophia, blinking in the light of the airplane-decorated lamp.
"Come to bed, Serduska," she said. "It's late."
Frank sighed and stubbed out his cigarette, then began replacing the chess pieces in their box.
"I'm sorry, Kohanya. I can't stop worrying about that U-2 pilot."
Although he'd been pulled from the U-2 project, Frank had been unable to let go of Powers. Where were the Soviets holding him? What had they learned from him? Were they really going to execute him for espionage? The missing KGB man, Icicle, nagged at Frank like an extracted tooth. He had no new facts about the man, but his intuition insisted that Icicle and Powers were somehow connected.
"Maybe you should take a Milton."
Frank shook his head.
"The poor kid's only a little older than our son. There's nothing you can do to help."
"Well," Frank held the last white pawn in his hand,
"I've been thinking about that."
"Frank!" The shock in her voice made his head whip around. Her face was rigid with fear and anger.
"Surely you can't be considering turning yourself into scare." "I have a unique ability, Kohanya. Perhaps now is the time to use it, for the good of the country."
He reached to comfort her.
"Madness!"
She avoided his arms and stalked across the room, her arms folded tightly across her chest.
"You're not Golden Boy, Frank. You're a grandfather, a balding, middle-aged bureaucrat. You don't even put pepper on your eggs."
She turned, and he saw tears flowing down the lines of her face.
"And think of the children. What will people think if they learn their father is one of them?"
Frank looked down at the last pawn, still in his hand, and its matching velvet-lined compartment. Every piece had a place where it belonged, and a pawn could not fill the space designed for a queen. He sighed.
"You're right, of course."
Sophia's slippers sloughed across the floor, and she pressed her soft warmth against his back, embracing him from behind. He set down the pawn and turned to gather her up in his arms. They stood that way for a while, rocking gently side to side as they held each other.
"Now come to bed,"
Sophia said at last. Frank turned out the light, leaving the pawn standing in the dark beside the empty chessboard.
Friday, May 13th. Frank sat alone in his office, a greasy street vendor sausage sitting cold and half-eaten on the corner of his desk. He hadn't had a proper lunch in 2 weeks, instead spending every spare moment on the Powers matter. In recent days, the already tense international situation had grown steadily worse, with Soviet bombers probing into Alaska and Canada, and increasing activity at intermediate-range missile sites threatening Turkey and Pakistan. But Frank had been focusing his attention on the elusive missing icicle. He was no longer the only KGB man who'd vanished. Others had also disappeared from play. Correlating that information with the latest signal intercepts on transportation and security budgets, Frank had deduced the epicenter of this mysterious activity. Vladimirsky Central, a high-security prison in the Russian city of Vladimir. Powers must be there. Frank was nearly ready to present his findings to his superiors. He just needed a few more facts to back up his intuition. Dulles would be displeased that he'd continued to work on the Powers case, but if Frank could present a solid enough report, he'd have no choice but to accept his conclusions. Whether he'd act on those conclusions was another question, but that was beyond Frank's control. He shuffled through flimsy papers, pink and tan and yellow, spattered with red secret and top secret stamps, looking for definitive evidence. This was the very latest intelligence. Frank had nagged the document control officers to the point that they were shoveling anything they could at him just to get rid of him. It was possible that he was the first to see this data. So when he read the report from an agent in the sleepy Moscow suburb of Nagingsk, claiming that Roman Andreevich Rudenko, Procurator General of the Soviet Union, had been seen with Generals Boris Oglebsky, Vorobyev, and Zakharov, on a private car aboard an eastbound train, his mouth went dry. Rudenko is the Soviet equivalent of the U.S. Attorney General. Boris Oglebsky, Vorobyev, and Zakharov made up the military division of the Supreme Court of the USSR, and Nagingsk was on the route from Moscow to Vladimir. Espionage trials in the Soviet Union were conducted in secret. If those four were in Vladimir, they could be trying Powers right now, and Frank might be the only one who knew it. But the agent in Nagingsk had made very few previous reports. Frank couldn't determine how much credence to give this one. He needed more data to be certain. Shuffling through stacks and stacks of paper, scanning and discarding each one as quickly as possible, he soon built up a pile of loose sheets on the floor at his feet. Then something he'd read snagged at his brain just as his fingers were letting go of the sheet. He scrambled to find it again, crumpling and tearing other papers in his haste, then held it up to the light. It was an intercepted telegram from the Bureau of Prisons to the Commandant of the Red Army Orchestra and Chorus. Regret must cancel your performance 17 May 1960 at Vladimir Prison. Read the uppercase Cyrillic letters. Exercise yard unavailable that day. Vladimir Prison. Supreme Court. Procurator General. Secret trial. Exercise yard. Execution by firing squad. It was a slim and twisty thread of evidence, to be sure, but Frank had ignored his intuitions before, and the result had been nothing but ignominy and shame. His professional specialty, his whole life, was assembling estimates from seemingly unconnected facts, and he'd rarely felt such certainty about a conclusion. The specified date was 4 days from now, 3 days given the time difference between Washington and Moscow. To have a chance of saving Powers, his superiors would have to be informed immediately. Frank gathered up the papers he'd need to back up his conclusions and charged out the door. He didn't even stop for his hat. Robert was on a plane to Geneva for a NATO meeting, so Frank swallowed and went to Dulles. "The director is in a meeting at the White House," his secretary said. "He won't be back here until tomorrow." But Frank's progress was checked by the guard at the West Wing security desk.
"I'm sorry, sir. Director Dulles is meeting with the president. Please wait over there."
"How long?" Frank clutched the folder full of papers as though it were the steering wheel of his destiny.
"I can't tell you, sir."
Frank sat in the indicated chair, but only for a moment. He bounced up and began pacing the floor. He glanced at the clock. 4:15 p.m. to 11:15 p.m. Moscow time. In 45 minutes, it would be Saturday there. If Frank was right, Powers' execution was set for Tuesday, probably at dawn. 80 hours from now, more or less. If he could only turn back the clock. Frank halted in his tracks.
I'm sorry, he told the guard. I can't wait. I have to find some other way.
He stepped around the corner. There was another guard here, but his attention was focused outward, and Frank was behind him. This was madness. If Frank actually did what he was contemplating, his life would be changed forever. He might never see his wife or children again. And Powers was just one man, a man who had known even as he'd boarded the U-2 that he might never return from his mission. But Frank had sworn an oath to defend the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Powers was not just one man. His life was symbolic of much more, and rescuing him might prevent a much greater confrontation. Frank's wife might not understand, but what he did for the country, he did for her and for the children. He clutched his folder and concentrated. A rush of sound like a hard wind in Frank's ears stole away the ticking clock and all other sounds. Outside the window, a flag froze in mid-wave. Frank pushed through the thick, jelly-like air past the West Wing guard, who sat unblinking behind his desk. The door behind him felt heavy as lead, but beyond it lay a long, straight corridor, empty except for two armed Marines at rigid attention beside the third door on the left. Behind that door, as Frank had surmised, was a small, dark conference room where three unmoving men sat at a table, staring grimly at an overhead projector screen. By the projector's light, Frank recognized Dulles and Eisenhower. The third seemed vaguely familiar, though Frank couldn't name him. Frank stared at the president, who sat frozen with the bright rectangle of the screen reflecting in his glasses. In a moment, Frank would reveal himself to him, and his civilian life would be over. Or he could back out right now, and no one would ever know. No one but Frank himself. Frank gasped in a breath, and the roaring in his ears was replaced by the softer sound of the projector's fan. A moment later came another gasp, this one from Dulles, as he noticed Frank's sudden appearance.
What the devil?
Immediately he leapt to cover the projector's lens with his hand. That unexpected action drew Frank's attention to the screen. Before Dulles could block the light, he took in the words Aquatone and Captured and Rampart and Pilot. Aquatone was the cryptonym for the U-2, Frank knew. And R-A was the digraph for cryptonyms related to the wildcard virus. If Rampart was the code name for the captured U-2 pilot, that meant...
We have a problem, said the third man as he flicked on the room lights. This man knows who and what Rampart is.
Suddenly Frank realized who the third man was. Lawrence Haig, the stockbroker who'd been the first person inducted into SCARE, a telepath. He was 5 years older than the newsreel footage Frank had seen of him, but those sharp eyes and high forehead were unmistakable. It was a good thing Frank had gone into the room intending to reveal himself.
Yes, I have just deduced from the information on that slide that Francis Gary Powers is an ace, he said.
To his own surprise, his voice was level.
I came here to tell you that he has already been tried and sentenced to death.
Eisenhower's expression was grim.
How did you get in here?
I too am an ace.
There, he'd said it. No going back now.
An ace screw-up, maybe,
Dulles snarled. Eisenhower stood, interrupting Dulles.
What was that you said about Powers being sentenced?
Frank quickly laid out the intelligence and his interpretation. Dulles was frankly skeptical.
This man couldn't find his own ass with a map and a flashlight, he sniffed.
I know this analysis has a lot of problematic connections, Frank replied, but where I fell down before was in failing to respect my intuition.
He turned and addressed Eisenhower directly.
Mr. President, I was born in Russia before the revolution. I've been watching these Bolsheviks since their earliest days. I know how they work. I know how they think. And I've made a lifetime study of their politics and government. You must believe that I know that Powers has either already been convicted of espionage or will be shortly and will be put to death by firing squad in the exercise yard at Vladimirsky Central Prison on Tuesday, May 17th.
Is this your ace power? Eisenhower asked. Some kind of super deduction?
No, Mr. President. Analysis is my profession. My power is to bring time to a halt, Everything stops but me. From your perspective, I appear to move instantaneously.
This was a speech he'd rehearsed in his head 1,000 times.
If you will permit me to demonstrate.
Dulles rolled his eyes, but Eisenhower looked to Haig, who nodded. Frank focused his mind. The world began to roar, and the three men froze in place. Pushing through the heavy, resistant air, he walked up to each of them and removed the wallets from their inside jacket pockets. He moved to the far corner of the room before releasing time to its usual flow.
"Over here," he said.
All three men started and whirled to face him, then padded their pockets with increasing agitation. He held up the wallets. Haig gave him a slow, appraising nod. This was a moment he'd been awaiting for 5 years. He wanted to savor his triumph, but he just felt tired, weary down to his bones, 10 years older. It was all he could do to remain standing.
"Mr. President,"
he said, his voice hoarse,
"I've seen how much Powers means to you. Please, please believe me. What I know, what I've learned, what I can do, let me help you in any way I can."
Dulles was the first to recover.
"Sir, this is an outrage," he sputtered to Eisenhower.
But the president ignored Dulles, turning instead to Haig.
"Is this man telling the truth?"
"As he understands it, yes."
"Any black marks on his record?"
This was directed to Dulles.
"He failed to determine that the Soviets had Powers."
"He wasn't the only one.
Anything else?"
Dulles glowered at Frank before replying,
"Not to my knowledge."
Eisenhower looked into Frank's eyes for a long time, considering, and despite his own exhaustion, Frank realized that this man really did bear the weight of the world on his shoulders, and had for nearly 8 years.
"All right," he said at last. "Mr. Mazursky, was it?"
"Majewski, sir."
Eisenhower straightened.
"Mr. Majewski, by the authority of the Exotic Powers Control Act and the Special Conscription Act, I place you under the command of the Senate Committee on Ace Resources and Endeavors, effective immediately. You understand your rights and responsibilities under the Act?"
"I do, sir."
"Mr. Haig here is the Director of SCARE, and from now on you will be reporting to him. Larry, please read Mr. Majewski into Rampart."
Haig pulled a paper from his briefcase and asked Frank to spell his name and provide his date of birth and social security number. The paper bore a SCARE letterhead and resembled the CIA security clearance form, except that the description of the compartment was just a brief, handwritten scrawl. Francis Gary Powers, Abilities and History, the ink still wet, and the statement about unauthorized disclosure included the words, "Any disclosure whatsoever constitutes treason," and "subject to immediate execution without trial." Frank swallowed and signed the form, which was then countersigned by Haig, Dulles, and Eisenhower himself. Haig then explained that Gary Powers, callsign Eagle Eye, was indeed an ace, and America's most important surveillance asset.
"His ace power is incredible distance vision," Haig said. "Better than our best telescopic cameras. And he's had years of training in understanding what he sees. Powers is irreplaceable, and he must be returned unharmed."
Eisenhower thanked Haig for his presentation and took the floor.
"This meeting was called," he said, "to consider alternatives to Eagle Eye and damage control in the wake of his loss. However, now that you're here, I believe we have a chance to rescue him. The unique combination of your knowledge of Russia, CIA training, and ace power seems heaven-sent for this situation. Do I recall correctly that you are a native speaker of Russian?"
"Da,"
Frank replied, his heart hammered as he realized what Eisenhower was about to suggest. But Dulles, who'd been steaming quietly, now burst out,
"Mr. President, you cannot possibly be considering sending this man into Russia. He's not an operative, he's an analyst. He has no training in subterfuge, evasion, resistance to interrogation."
"Alan,"
Eisenhower said,
"shut up."
An indefinable note of command in his tone stopped Dulles cold.
"Eagle Eye is so critical to the security of this nation that to recover him, I am prepared to risk the loss of our newest asset."
A chill settled in the pit of Frank's gut as he realized the president was referring to him.
"And any resulting collateral damage. In any case, Mr. Majewski is no longer under your command."
He turned away from Dulles in what Frank interpreted as a deliberate snub.
Mr. Majewski, Eisenhower continued, now focusing his attention on Frank. I'm sorry to place such a burden on you, and to put you in so much danger. But as I'm sure you're aware, your country needs you and your unique abilities. Mr. Haig will give you as much in the way of training and assistance as possible before you leave for your mission.
Frank opened his mouth, but nothing came out. After a couple of attempts, he simply nodded. The pawn that reaches the last rank, he told himself, becomes a queen.
Haig took him to an office building on F Street, supposedly a real estate law office, but actually the headquarters of SCARE. There he underwent a battery of medical tests, administered with polite but firm efficiency by a staff, including Dr. Thatcher, a 4-foot-tall hairless man with frog-belly white skin, yellow-slit eyes, and fangs, who drew a syringe of Frank's blood and proceeded to taste it before writing extensive notes in shorthand. It was the first time Frank had ever been in the same room as a joker, but he tried to remain calm. Immediately thereafter, Frank was subjected to a series of exercises designed to establish the boundaries of his ace power. He held on to a stopwatch. Anything that touched his skin was carried with him outside of time, and kept time stopped for as long as he could, which turned out to be about 11 minutes, though it felt like far more. With time stopped, he ran laps and lugged weights of up to 30 pounds, and he did something he'd never even considered before. He took another human being along with him outside of time, a volunteer who walked slowly as Frank led him by the hand. The volunteer said that the experience was strange and frightening, a delirious, semi-conscious rush without volition, like a waking dream of driving at top speed. But after it was over, there seemed to be no ill effects. When a second volunteer was added, Frank found it too difficult to even take a single step. After those tests, he repeated the medical exam. No one told him a thing about what they'd learned, if anything. Then he was permitted to call his wife, though only under strict observation, and only to tell her that he was on a special assignment and would not be able to come home for at least several days. By now it was nearly 2 in the morning. The SCARE offices had a few small sleeping rooms, windowless and spare, but otherwise fairly comfortable. The door did not lock, either from the inside or the outside. Frank removed his tie and shoes and stretched out on the bed to rest for a bit, certain that his mind was too full of questions and new experiences for sleep. The next thing he knew, he was being awakened by a polite male secretary who told him it was 6 o'clock. He also gave Frank a large, battered suitcase with the Cyrillic initials YAG. It contained several changes of clothing, heavy, badly made, and ill-fitting, with labels in Russian, shoes, handkerchiefs, and other furnishings, and what looked to Frank's eye like a genuine Russian passport with his own photograph and the name Yatsik Grabowski. As he shaved with a dull and pitted Russian-made safety razor and gritty soap, Frank reflected that it was a good thing he wasn't used to the smooth, lubricated aerosol shaving cream his barber kept insisting he should try. The moment he emerged from the bathroom, he was hurried to a meeting with Haig and several other very serious men, who presented him with a thick folder of papers, a detailed plan for Power's rescue. In order for the timing to work, he would have to leave for Andrews Air Force Base within the hour. Did he have any questions? Frank read the plan over a cup of horrible coffee and a stale donut. It seemed to take into account everything he and SCARE had learned about his abilities in the previous day, by pushing them to their absolute limits. The plan would work, he thought, as long as nothing unexpected happened and Frank maintained the same level of performance. But there was one part of the plan that Frank couldn't countenance. He would be accompanied by an experienced field officer to help him with insertion and extraction. But the plan called for the officer to accompany Frank into the prison and then, while Frank took powers out using his wildcard talent, make his way out on his own.
I'm going into Russia to break a man out of an escape-proof prison, Frank said, stabbing the prison map with a forefinger. I won't leave another man behind in his place.
Haig's hands gripped each other on the tabletop. That's his job, Frank, and it's your job to follow my orders. Frank met Haig's hard stare with one of his own.
I won't do it.
They glared at each other for a long moment while sweat trickled down Frank's sides under the heavy Soviet jacket. But it was Haig who blinked first.
Fine, he said.
He turned to one of the other scare planners. We'll use the alternate plan where Frank goes in and out of the prison by himself. Frank was astonished that Haig had collapsed so suddenly and thoroughly. Don't be so surprised, Haig said, although Frank had not spoken. I can see exactly where you will and won't compromise. He stood and extended his hand. I think you're a sentimental fool, but I wish you godspeed. The planner stood as well. Frank's knees were quaking so much he could barely lever himself upright, but he managed.
Thank you, sir. I'll give it my best effort.
The plane that Frank boarded at Andrews was a big C-130 Hercules, and Frank was the only passenger.
All this for me?
He asked the pilot, a slim and leathery Navy man with pale blue eyes whose name patch read A. Dearborn.
I fly where I'm told to, he shrugged.
Takeoff was rough, with the empty cargo compartment rattling and the four huge engines roaring like tornadoes, but the flight soon settled down to routine.
It's 15 hours to Helsinki, Dearborn said, including a refueling stop in Keflavik.
Frank slept for a while, but despite his exhaustion, earplugs, and his Soviet wool suit, the noise and cold woke him up after a few hours. He read over the rescue plan until he was sure he'd memorized every detail. He inventoried the contents of his suitcase and counted every button on every shirt. By the time Dearborn turned over the controls to his co-pilot for a break and came back to offer Frank a sandwich, he'd gone all the way from terror to boredom and out the other side to desperation.
I don't suppose there's a chess set on this plane.
You're in luck.
Dearborn hauled one out from his duffel bag, a tiny travel set, the wooden pieces of which plugged into holes in the board.
Always glad to have another player on one of these long flights,
Dearborn said as he set up the board.
What's your rating?
I don't know. I don't usually play against other people.
Ah, play by mail then.
Dearborn, playing white, advanced his queen's pawn.
No, I just study the games of champions, play them out on the board, analyze them.
It was surprisingly painful to confess his hobby. He knew that chess wasn't just an intellectual pastime. It was also a game, to be played with other people as a form of social interaction. But that aspect just wasn't appealing to him.
I haven't actually played a real game of chess in, it must be 10 years.
He advanced his own queen's pawn to confront Dearborn's.
No time like the present, then.
Dearborn moved his queen's bishop's pawn forward in the classic queen's gambit opening. At this point, Frank could decline the queen's gambit by advancing his king's pawn, retaining control of the center, or accept it by taking the pawn Dearborn had just advanced, gaining more freedom to act later. He found himself unable to decide. He reached out his hand, then drew it back. And again, he trembled with uncertainty. After so many years of detailed study and analysis of some of the greatest chess games in history, against a human opponent he couldn't even manage a classic opening in a meaningless, casual game. Dulles was right. He was an analyst, not a field operative. What in God's name did he think he was doing here?
Hey, said Dearborn. Hey, are you okay?
I'm fine,
Frank lied, and blew his nose to mask the tears. The Russian handkerchief was stiff and rough. He folded it, tucked it back in his pocket, drew in a breath, and captured Dearborn's pawn. He'd given up so much control of his life already. Why not give up control of the center? It might help in the endgame. Play continued. Dearborn was a stodgy, conservative player, clearly failing to look more than a few moves ahead. But somehow he always seemed to be in just the right place to counter Frank's attacks.
Just lucky, I guess,
he said, capturing Frank's knight.
There is no luck in chess.
Frank advanced his remaining knight.
Check.
Maybe so, but I've always been lucky somehow. It could be me over there right now instead of Francis Gary Powers.
He took Frank's knight with his bishop.
Oh?
Frank nudged his queen one square to threaten that bishop.
Yeah, I was approached by the U2 program, passed all the exams and interviews, got the clearances, everything. But then I got the mumps. Mumps! Can you believe it? And missed the window to enter the training. By the time I was cleared to fly again, they didn't have any openings.
He swooped the endangered bishop across the board, but as soon as he let go of the piece, his face fell.
Oh, I didn't mean to put it there.
Nuts.
He frowned, examining the board, then suddenly sat up straight.
Hey! Checkmate!
Frank hoped that wasn't an omen. Frank was met in Helsinki by a bulky man with a wide, unsmiling face, who introduced himself in Russian as Pyotr Andreevich Malinov. He took Frank's suitcase to a stodgy gray Volvo sedan, and Frank thought he was just the driver until the door closed and he provided Frank with the confirmation code. He was Frank's field officer, a trustworthy CIA agent of long standing who had often worked with Scare.
"What's your alias?"
Frank asked him.
"What should I call you?"
"You will address me as Pyotr Andreevich Malinov. If you don't know my real name, you can slip up and call me by it. And you, as far as I am concerned, are nothing but Yacek Grabowski, my wife's slightly simple cousin, whom I am escorting to Moscow for the agricultural exposition as a favor to her. If there are any awkward questions, just act stupid."
It was clear that he didn't think that would be much of a challenge. A protest began to form behind Frank's lips. He was a CIA analyst. He had advanced degrees in economics and foreign affairs, but he kept silent. He would be depending on this man for his life, and he knew his business. There was no sense in antagonizing him. Malinov barely spoke to Frank as they drove to the Helsinki train station, and as soon as they were settled in their hard, second-class seats, he pulled his hat over his eyes and went to sleep. Frank seethed in his heavy, damp coat. This was the man who was supposed to protect him. But Frank was bone-tired himself, and despite the uncomfortable seat and his many concerns, he too soon found his eyes falling shut. As he drifted off to sleep, Frank thought he heard Malinov wish him good night. Perhaps the other man wasn't really asleep at all. Frank woke with a start at a hard poke in his ribs. Four Russian border guards in steel helmets with machine guns slung across the backs of their long green coats were making their way down the length of the train car.
"Passport,"
Malinov hissed. But Frank's passport wasn't in his coat pocket. Quickly he searched his other coat pockets, his pants pockets, the seat beneath him.
I'm sorry.
His pulse hammered in his ears.
"Find it,"
Malinov muttered under his breath. Two of the guards approached.
"Passports,"
one said crisply. Malinov handed over his own passport.
"I'm so sorry," he said, "but my cousin seems to have misplaced his."
He tapped his temple in a significant gesture and grinned.
"He's Polish."
Frank wouldn't have thought that any other emotions could penetrate his terror, but he found that anger at the ethnic slur did manage to make itself felt, even as he continued to pat his pockets. Malinov and the guards had a chuckle at Frank's expense, which turned into outright laughter when the wayward document turned up in his shirt pocket. The guard flipped open Frank's fraudulent passport.
"Please confirm for me your date of birth."
Frank's heart just about stopped. He couldn't remember what birth date the counterfeit document bore. Was it his own? If not, what was it? Agonized seconds crawled by. This time, he was frozen and the rest of the world moved.
"Polish,"
Malinov said again and shrugged. This time, even the man in the seat across the aisle joined in the laughter. Still laughing, the guard handed back Frank's passport and moved down the aisle.
"You didn't have to insult me like that,"
Frank said once the guards had passed into the next car. His heart rate had dropped to only twice normal.
"Left or reduces suspicion," Malinov replied. "And it got you out of that jam."
He shrugged.
"What else would you have had me do?"
Later he realized that he could have used his power to search for the passport, or to inspect it while the guard held it in his hand. But he hadn't thought of it when it might have done some good. 8 years of hiding his power, of pretending to be someone who was no different from anyone else, had kept him from remembering at the key moment what he could do. What in God's name did he think he was doing here? Maybe Dulles had been right after all. On Tuesday, May 17th, at 3 a.m. Moscow time, Frank stood shivering in the rain outside the gate of Vladimirsky Central Prison, feeling very small. The prison's walls loomed high above. The rain that spattered down into Frank's face formed glowing halos around the floodlights mounted at intervals along the tops of the walls. Armed guards with dogs patrolled the perimeter. The interior was a warren of remote-controlled doors designed to make escape impossible. It was Russia's most secure prison. Frank was going to walk in and walk out again with Powers. Even with Frank's wildcard ability, it was only a mole within the prison that would make the rescue possible. The detailed map the mole had provided gave Frank a few places to rest, out of sight, when his power was exhausted. The list of time points clutched in Frank's hand, thrust deep in his coat pocket, would get him past the locked doors. The first of those times was 3:05 a.m., still 5 more minutes. Frank checked his watch, but not even his power could make that second hand move any faster. Moscow rain tasted of concrete and sulfur. Finally, 3:05 arrived. Frank took a deep breath and concentrated. The roar of stopped time assaulted his exhausted ears. Raindrops halted in their downward rush, each one revealing itself as an irregular flattened disc, not raindrop-shaped at all. Frank pushed through the gluey air, suspended drops sliding across his face or absorbing into his coat. He simply walked past the outer gate, a diagonally striped barrier arm whose two armed guards stood frozen in their raincoats in the unmoving rain. The door of the prison building itself was not locked, nor were the next two doors, and the guards at each were no obstacle. But pushing the doors open and closed again took a substantial effort. Heavier and tighter than domestic doors, each one felt to Frank as though it weighed 100 pounds. He was literally working against time. Frank mopped his brow and pressed forward, deeper into the prison. Now came the first of the serious obstacles, an airlock with heavy steel and glass doors on either side, each locked by a deadbolt that could only be opened by the press of a button at the guard station between the doors. But the mole had promised that he could unlatch both doors for 1 minute, from 3:05 to 3:06, and no one would notice. Instinctually, Frank glanced at his watch as he approached the first door, and felt a moment of panic. It read 3:13. But of course, that reflected his personal time. The clock on the wall was frozen at a few seconds past 3:05. He put his weight against the door, and, with heavy reluctance, it swung open. The second door was also unlocked, thank God, but took even more of an effort to open. After pushing the second door shut, Frank leaned against the cold concrete wall for the space of several gasping breaths. But outside of time, there was no rest. Even breathing was work. He had to get to his first hiding place before he grew too tired to continue. The harsh lights inside the security zone battered at Frank's eyes as he slogged through the thick, resistant air toward the safety of a maintenance closet. By the time he reached it, his vision was beginning to swim, and it was all he could do to work the latch and drag the door open. As soon as he shut it, delivering himself into blessed darkness, he released his power. Trembling, he allowed himself to slide down the door until he sat on the floor, panting as quietly as possible. The filthy, dark closet was chill and smelled of chlorine, but it was still better than the unearthly roar and stillness of the world outside of time. The mole's next time point was 3:15. 10 minutes to rest was not enough. 10 minutes to wait helplessly in a dark closet, trembling in fear each time someone came clomping and rattling by outside the door, was too much. He imagined the door opening suddenly, flooding the crowded little space with light and exclamations of surprise. If that happened, he could freeze time again and escape that way, but the plan would be disrupted and an alarm might be raised. And where would he hide until the next exit time point? Finally, the glowing hands pointed to 3:15. So glad to leave this stinking closet, so afraid to face the roar of frozen time, he concentrated and called up his power. It took all his might to push the petrified door open. Never before had Frank spent so much time out of time. Every step was climbing a mountain. Every door he opened and closed was Sisyphus's rock. Maximum security area, read the stenciled Cyrillic letters over the next time point door. This one was a sliding door, electronically operated, and though it was unlatched as the mole had promised, all Frank's remaining strength was not enough to force it open. He found a steel truncheon leaning in a corner and used that to lever the door open just enough to squeeze through. Then he had to put the truncheon back, carefully matching it to its remembered position. Damn it, which end had been up? It was getting harder and harder to think straight. On the other side, he turned and immediately confronted a dark and scowling face. Recoiling in panic, he cracked his head on the metal door behind him before his reason overcame his initial reaction.
The broad, muscular man in the uniform of a Soviet army colonel, his name patch read Polyakov, was as frozen as everything else in the prison, petrified in the act of charging angrily toward the door Frank had just emerged from. Frank leaned against the door for a moment, rubbing his head and chiding himself for stupidity.
Wait. Polyakov. That name was familiar. It was one of the possible names listed for the KGB officer designated Icicle by the CIA. And now here he was, in Vladimirsky Central Prison, in the maximum security wing where Powers was imprisoned. Frank had been right all along, and now he even had a name for the man. Frank allowed himself a moment of smug triumph, snapping his fingers under the KGB man's unmoving nose before ducking past him and pressing down the hall. Powers' cell, number 37, was the first one on the right, with the name Hovers, Powers in Cyrillic, chalked above the door. Now nothing stood between Frank and success. But the door wouldn't open. Frank tried again, pressing down on the rust-flecked steel handle with all his might. It didn't budge. The mole was supposed to have arranged for the door to be unlocked from 3:10 to 3:40. Everything else had gone exactly as planned. Frank rattled the handle one more time. Nothing. He cast about for some other way to open the door, but it was heavy, solid steel, the lock mechanism and hinges well protected and reinforced, and there was nothing in this empty concrete hallway he could use against it. To have come so far, overcome so much, only to be thwarted by a simple lock. No. Wait. The key. Polyakov, frozen at the moment of striding away from Power's cell, must have the key. Frank waded to the unmoving KGB man through air that seemed even thicker than before. It didn't take long to identify the hard lump of keys in Polyakov's pants pocket, but the position of his petrified leg and arm made it impossible for Frank to extract it. He could move the arm by force, he thought, or cut the pocket open with his penknife, but either action would startle Polyakov and make him raise an alarm. And Frank had another 10-minute time point to get through, with Powers, on the way out. He had to get the key from Polyakov, and in such a way that he would not notice. He moved to a position behind Polyakov, making sure no other frozen eyes could see him where he stood. The sliding door stood open by 9 inches, but Polyakov's eyes were downcast. He'd have to risk it. He released time to its normal rate.
"Burn the idiot who left it unlocked!"
Polyakov muttered as he stepped forward. Stopping time again so soon was like trying to stop the flow in the middle of a long, hard piss, but somehow Frank managed. He drew in a gasping breath of the roaring, gluey air, then pushed forward to Polyakov's side. The pocket was now accessible. Thank God. He fished the keys from it, hoping that Polyakov, in mid-stride, wouldn't notice the intrusion, and dragged himself back to Power's cell. The key stamped 37 fit the lock, though working the latch and opening the door felt like dragging a railroad car uphill. Powers lay on his side on the bed. He looked like hell, his eyes sunken and his mouth set in a despairing scowl, but it was definitely him. Frank's heart pounded and his vision began to blur. The roaring in his ears had grown to an onrushing railroad engine. He desperately needed a rest. But with 2 doors open and the keys in his hand, he didn't dare. Somehow he had to keep going. Frank hauled Powers to his feet by brute force. It would probably leave bruises, but there was no alternative. Walking backwards, leading the insensate pilot by both hands, he guided Powers out the door, past the frozen Polyakov, and through the sliding door. Then he went back to close and lock the cell door, replace the keys in Polyakov's pocket, and slide the cell block door shut.
"I wish I could see your face,"
he gasped to Polyakov as he put all his weight against the sliding door handle.
"When you find Powers mysteriously vanished from a locked cell."
He was supposed to take Powers back to the maintenance closet where he'd rested on the way in, but he couldn't possibly make it that far. Already he was half-leaning on Powers even as he guided him down the hall, his vision dimming and his steps wobbly. Here was a bathroom. It would have to do. He led Powers inside, barely remembering to reset his watch to the hall clock before closing and locking the door behind himself. So tired. No, he couldn't relax just yet. He lay Powers down on the floor like a stiff, man-sized puppet. He leaned hard on Powers' chest and placed one hand firmly over his mouth and nose. He let go of time. Powers spasmed and tried to squirm out of Frank's grasp. From his perspective, he had just been whipped from his cell in an instantaneous rush and was now being pinned and suffocated by a stranger. But even weakened by 17 days in Soviet custody, he was stronger than Frank.
Be still!
Frank hissed into Powers' ear in English.
I'm here to rescue you.
Powers stopped struggling, though every muscle quivered with tension.
I'm from Scare, he whispered. Lawrence Haig sent me. I am cleared for Aquatone and Rampart. We are still inside the prison, and if we are discovered here, we will both die. Do you understand?
Powers nodded slowly, his eyes wide above Frank's trembling hand. Frank released Powers and slumped against the wall, letting his eyes sag closed. He felt a million years old.
You're an ace?
Powers whispered. He had a slow Virginia drawl.
Yes, I can stop time, but only for a little while.
More useful than being Mr. Peepers.
Powers' voice dripped with bitterness. Then he took a deep breath, let it out.
What's your name? Franciszek Majewski. That's Polish for Francis, actually, just like you.
Powers rolled his eyes.
Please, call me Gary. Only my mam and pap call me Francis.
I'm Frank.
They shook hands. On Friday, May 20th, at 11 a.m., Frank entered the Oval Office, and the president came out from behind his desk to greet him. Dulles and Haig, also present, stood where they were. Although honored by the gesture, Frank couldn't help but notice that Eisenhower did not shake his hand.
It's okay, Mr. President, he said. I'm not infectious.
Frank knew he looked like hell, even though he'd slept much of the way back, including most of the limousine ride from Andrews Air Force Base. He still felt weak. He'd lost much of his remaining hair. Vague pains troubled his joints, and his walk had become an old man's shuffling step. He hoped that a few days or weeks of rest would bring his vitality back, but he feared it would not. Using his power had always aged him unnaturally, far in excess of the minutes or hours he spent outside of time, and the unprecedented effort he'd spent on the Powers rescue mission had surely cost him dearly. He might have lost 5 years in that one hellish night.
Welcome back to America, Frank, Eisenhower said, and escorted him to one of the wing chairs beside the fireplace. We're all proud of the work you've done for your country.
Eisenhower glanced at Dulles and Haig. Haig grinned and gave a satisfied nod. Dulles, glowering, stared at his black wingtips. Eisenhower cleared his throat. Alan? It took Dulles a long moment to meet Frank's eyes.
You did well, he finally admitted.
Thank you,
Frank said, accepting a cup of coffee from the president's own hand.
Has there been any fallout from Powers' escape?
It was the one question that had nagged at him all the way home. Would Khrushchev, already angered by the spy plane intrusion in his territory, be even more provoked by the mysterious disappearance of Powers from his most secure prison? Had Frank's mission only succeeded in moving the doomsday clock closer to midnight? Eisenhower shook his head.
They've acknowledged that they've lost Powers. They couldn't deny it after his press conference in Helsinki, but publicly they haven't said a word about how he escaped, and even in private they've been a bit less belligerent.
Haig sat in the wing chair opposite Frank.
They know it must have been an ace who helped Powers escape, he said, but politically they can't admit our aces are better than theirs. They'll just have to swallow their pride and keep quiet.
But Dulles was less sanguine.
They kept quiet for 5 years of U-2 overflights, too.
Eisenhower shot Dulles a look.
None of your pessimism, Alan. This is a celebratory occasion.
From his pocket he pulled a folded paper and handed it to Frank. It was an official commendation on Scare stationery, signed by the president and sealed with a red ribbon.
This will go in your file, Frank. I'd love to give you a ticker tape parade, but...
He shrugged. You know how it is. He held out his hand. After a moment, Frank understood what the open hand meant, and he returned the paper. Of course, he could not keep a copy. As a Scare agent, he no longer existed. Frank swallowed.
I know you can't acknowledge my work, he said.
But,
His voice started to tremble, and he had to stop and try to regain his composure. Eisenhower waited patiently.
All I ask, he started again, is that you tell my wife I died heroically in the service of my country.
He hoped the secret facility in the Nevada desert at least had air conditioning. Haig blinked.
You think we're going to send you to Watertown Strip?
He smirked and shook his head, and Frank remembered that Haig knew what Frank was thinking.
No, Frank, that's just a myth.
He and Dulles exchanged glances.
Well, the part about Ace's being held prisoner there is, you won't just vanish. In fact, you'll be going home right after we debrief you.
You will continue at the CIA, Dulles said, though it was plain he didn't like the idea. As cover, performing assignments for SCARE only when necessary. You'll probably spend as many nights at home as before, maybe more.
It's like being a spy in your own country, Haig continued. And in your case, we already know you can keep a secret.
The pawn that reaches the last rank becomes a queen, Frank thought. Though even a queen could be captured, or could be dead of old age in 5 years. It all depended on how the piece was played. But for now, he could return to his home, removed from the board and placed securely back in the space that fit him.
Thank you, sir, he said.
No, thank you, Eisenhower said. And again he held out his hand, this time to shake Frank's. Welcome to SCARE, Special Agent Stopwatch.